Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Squall. Oh, there we go. The band finally joined in. I thought maybe I had a squall with the union. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 on a not-so-beautiful Sunday in late May in downtown Urbana, or downtown wouldn't be quite right. We're back at you live today, and we're talking about what's hot in the news, which is going on in Iraq, the press coverage, the Newsweek story. And we're going to have as our guest one of the premier critics of news media, professor of journalism, a frequent guest on Media Matters. I think you'll all enjoy today's show. Stay tuned, if you will, for Media Matters with Robert Jensen. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Among the many politicians in attendance at the National Conference for Media Reform in St. Louis were Democrat FCC commissioners Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein. I had a chance to sit down and talk with Commissioner Copps on a variety of subjects. The largest ones on his mind are the impending congressional rewrite of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and the FCC's second stab at revising rules related to media ownership. After the revisions made in 2003 were torpedoed by massive public outcry and a successful court challenge, Copps is concerned that the next go-round may occur with even less public involvement.
A lot of these big media companies may be thinking, well, let's see here, we've got control for a while longer here, so why don't we just kind of do it in a piecemeal approach. We'll repeal the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule 1 month, or we'll do something on duopolies the next month, a little bit at a time, don't get people excited. And if that strategy, if they get away with that strategy, we lose. Media democracy loses.
Instead, Copps would like to see a completely transparent process on any changes to media ownership rules, including nationwide hearings that the entire five-member commission would be required to attend. On the congressional front, Copps thinks the FCC is not serving the public as well as it could.
I think that the Federal Communications Commission could be doing a lot more to facilitate the passage of enlightened telecom legislation. We ought to be teeing up options for the Congress. I think Congress has a right to expect an independent agency to do that. And in point of fact, we have not been doing that.
There are several initiatives Copps would like to see the FCC take more seriously. One of them, he says, is an expansion of the low-power FM radio service. That's long overdue. A couple of years ago, Copps even expressed a smidgen of solidarity with an unlicensed broadcaster in Vermont who challenged FCC licensing rules in order to demonstrate their lack of service to the public interest. He stopped short of reiterating that sentiment this time, but still recognizes the need to expand real local community media opportunities.
In the atmosphere that we live, you can understand people getting frustrated with that and maybe getting involved in ways that go beyond where they should be involved. I think it just gets back to really the need to make sure we have good processes for low-power stations, and that's what we ought to be focusing on.
While most of the conference action stayed confined to the Millennium Hotel, a small group of activists took a two-block walk downtown to visit a radio and television station owned by Viacom. FCC regulations require any radio or TV station to keep a public file, which includes program logs, various financial and employment disclosure documents, and feedback from viewers and listeners. FCC rules also require stations to open their public files to public inspection during normal business hours. Mitchell Stepinchik of Chicago Media Action ended up at Viacom's TV outlet KMOV Channel 4.
I was with a team of four people, saw a number of very well organized, probably an array of maybe an entire half room full of files. We could only see a number of them just given the time issues that we were operating under. They were a little bit surprised since I imagine, in fact, they had said so that it almost never happens. Took a little bit of time for them to get their act together to actually invite us in and show us the files. But nonetheless, once they did, very cordial, very helpful.
Stepinchik managed to examine some canceled checks from political advertising run during the 2004 elections and some documents involving the station's commitment to children's programming. The most impressive find was KMOV's Dan Rather file.
Reams upon reams of printouts of emails from probably all over the country, never mind just St. Louis, in which people were complaining about Dan Rather, that they hate Dan Rather, that they want him off the air, they're just spewing bile and venom with regards to Dan Rather, and it filled an entire filing cabinet.
Stations that fail to properly maintain their public file or fail to allow adequate public access can be fined, although a station has never lost its license for a violation of the public file rules.
And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact. Major record labels claim that file sharing is killing the music business, but the stock prices tell a different story. In 2004, the parent companies of several major labels posted gains. For example, Sony shares gained 12% over 2003, Vivendi Universal rose 32%, and EMI was up 66%. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Indeed they are. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you live today. And before we go to today's guest, let me say thank you to all the listeners who came out a couple weeks ago to attend the conference on media consolidation and freedom of the press right here in Urbana, Illinois. I think everyone had a delightful time, got a lot of positive feedback, and we're going to try to tee something up like that again next year in May and keep this happening as an annual event here in the Urbana-Champaign community. Also, a handful of you I know made the trip last weekend down to St. Louis for the second National Conference for Media Reform. I think I want to thank you all for going down there. I think you had a good time, too. And people interested in what happened there, including Bill Moyer's speech a week ago today, can go to the freepress.net website and find all the speeches, videos, and our transcripts for some of the speeches as well at www.freepress.net. This week and for the last week or so, much of the news about the war in Iraq has been not about the war, but rather has been about not just in Iraq, also the war on terror, to be more accurate, but instead has been about Newsweek magazine and about its coverage of the flushing or the alleged flushing of a Koran down a toilet and the riot that ensued. And we've got here to talk about that today and really to talk a lot about just the press coverage of the war and a number of other issues. A frequent guest who's been on Media Matters, Bob Jensen, a professor of journalism at the University of Texas, author of several books, including Citizens of the Empire. Is that right, Bob?
That's it.
Citizens of the Empire. For my money, one of the smartest and more astute media critics working today. So, Bob Jensen, welcome to Media Matters.
Nice to be with you, Bob.
And let's just dive right in, Bob, and talk about the Newsweek incident. And why don't you sort of present, you know, how the official story and then your analysis?
Well, of course, Newsweek had now an infamous, very short note a couple earlier in May saying that there were these incidents, and at least one incident where a Quran was flushed down a toilet. Obviously not, I don't think you could flush an entire book down a toilet, as many people have pointed out. But the basic notion that the Quran was being desecrated in front of Muslim detainees, prisoners, in order to agitate them, upset them, and they would hope get information. What happened is that in classic sort of propaganda form, the administration seized on a very small and relatively irrelevant part of the story, which was the question of the sourcing. And instead of dealing with the fundamental problem, which is not just, of course, Quran desecration, it's the systematic brutalization of prisoners in American military prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan that includes this kind of use of religion to humiliate prisoners. It includes beatings, and we know from the military's own documents, includes up to criminal homicide. Now, that's the big story. But for the last 10 days, all we've heard about is this very, very trivial question of sourcing. Did the source that Newsweek used actually see the alleged report that had this note? Well, forget about the fact that we have, you know, piles of other evidence on this. The administration has been very effective, along with the right-wing media, at trying to train all of the attention on a very, very, what is essentially a minor issue. It isn't trivial in the sense that we should want reporters to accurately source their stories. But in the scheme of the big scheme of things, this is utterly trivial.
Yeah, and what's striking to me is how much attention this has gotten to the point that we're leading off with it on this program. When the Tony Blair memo came out, the Downing Street memo, a few weeks ago, which basically was, as they call it, the smoking gun memo, which showed that the U.S., in fact, consciously doctored data, intelligence data, before the war to produce a pro-war sentiment, even though they knew the facts weren't true. You know, that has gotten virtually no coverage by comparison.
Correct. And yes, it's unfortunate in a sense, although it does allow us to raise these issues of the bigger picture. And it also, I think, puts in front of us a very important question is, for people who are reflexively supportive of not just the Bush administration, but basically the American imperial endeavor, is there any evidence that could convince those people as to, you know, the fundamental corruption of that project? That is, how much evidence could you give to people and they would still reject it? Because here, as you point out on the smoking gun memo, we already knew the basic story well before this, but this confirms with kind of an impeccable source, that is British intelligence officials, British government officials, confirms that the Bush administration consciously was going to doctor intelligence to whip up a fear of a weapons of mass destruction threat from Iraq. Okay. Now, how much evidence can the American public ignore? That's really the question. How much evidence about the systematic abuses of an imperial army in Afghanistan and Iraq can the American public ignore? I think this is a very fundamental question, because if the facts don't matter, literally, if facts are irrelevant to policy discussions, we're in a very dangerous political time, to say the least.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. We have phone lines open, and please do call in if you have any questions or comments for Professor Jensen. The number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Those of you familiar with Bob Jensen know he can speak on a broad array of issues concerning media and journalism. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Texas, author of countless columns about media and journalism, and some books, including Citizens of the Empire, which came out about a year ago or 6 months ago.
It was last spring, yeah.
Time does fly, and we're having fun, I guess that's what that's supposed to mean. You know, Bob, one of the things you do is you periodically have an opportunity to go on to cable television news and be one of the talking heads in the debates with the pundits on the various issues of the day. And, you know, what's that like? I mean, you know, people watch Scarborough or Hannity and Combs or O'Reilly and see these shows from on the screen. But what's it like to be on it from the perspective of being a participant, particularly in your case, a participant who is going to be presenting a position that sort of goes way outside the range of debate as usually is on those channels?
Yes. Well, the experience itself is, quite frankly, rather surreal, because what I do is go down to a private studio in Austin and by satellite am linked up to New York or Washington or wherever the show is based. I stare into a camera. I don't see anybody else. All I have is an earpiece in which I talk. You've done this yourself, and you know it's a kind of odd experience as you, you're sort of almost floating off in space and trying to respond. You don't get to see the facial expressions of the other guests. You don't get to see the images that are being flashed on the screen. A very strange experience in this sort of televisual age. But the more important issue, of course, is the political and ideological struggle to take a debate that's really framed by either overtly right-wing or at best kind of centrist assumptions about the world, and try to inject into it a left analysis. And as everyone knows, that part of the work of that is just sort of destabilizing the assumptions, trying to contest the terminology, trying to suggest there are issues beyond what the host has just put out. Now, the degree to which one can do that depends partly on the host. On Hannity and Combs, it's particularly difficult because Sean Hannity is kind of like a rabid dog that's just been thrown a lot of raw meat, and it's sometimes hard to even get a word in.
Yeah, bad raw meat.
Yeah. Scarborough is a curious fellow. He's often a little more open to a discussion. On the other hand, I was on Scarborough twice this week and found myself sort of shut down, partly by the other guest and partly by a choice Scarborough made not to let me speak. So it's a bit of a crapshoot. But my reasoning for going on these as a leftist, as someone who wants to affect the politics of this country toward pushing it toward a left analysis, is we don't get many shots at a broad audience when you're on the left. And even though the structure of the show is designed to keep things superficial, even though the framing of the issues is designed to keep them in the right-wing camp, you know, you do get some chance to shove an idea into the public. And it seems to me, given the small number of opportunities folks like you and me might have, we should take them.
Now, I confess I've missed the Scarborough show recently, so I didn't have an opportunity to watch
your... I don't think that's a confession, Bob.
Okay.
I think that's a sign of character, but go ahead.
But, I mean, when you're on these shows, I mean, you know, the times I've seen people like you on these programs, they almost never get the last word, and rarely do they get to put a thought out there for longer than a sentence or two without, you know, having either Hannity or another guest just start bellowing and screaming. Interfering. So there's never really a chance to lay much out that doesn't turn into sort of something that's sort of vulgar or absurd.
Right. And I think that's the structural problem. These shows are really not news programs in any meaningful sense of the word. They're not constructed to give people a chance to articulate an idea. They're constructed as entertainment, as kind of a shout fest. And the producers know this, and they're well aware that they're in the entertainment business. Again, I go on them just because it might be a corrupted and profane space, but it's some space. But I think one goes into them with no illusions. The most common question I get from people is, how can you keep your cool on these? And I think the answer is you have to go into them knowing the way it's going to play out, realizing that part of the value of them, quite frankly, from my point of view, is that much of America thinks of the term leftist in very, to say the least, not positive ways. So if I can go on a show like this, be cool, calm, collected, and try to make a rational point, even if I don't get much of a shot at that, at least the American public sees someone with left ideas who isn't a caricature, because, of course, the news is so full of caricatures of the left, you know. And I don't mean this as an insult to people with a different hairstyle than mine, but, you know, often a leftist on the news is a young person with green hair and sort of a certain kind of aesthetic, we might say. Now, I don't have anything against people with green hair and who dress differently than me, but to much of America, especially sort of middle America, that's an automatic negative in their eyes. So the left gets associated with the counterculture. And what people come to think is no one who looks like them, and here again I realize this is our loaded terms I'm using, but when middle America thinks the left is nothing but people who are in the counterculture or who are somehow divorced from their world, well, that makes it very hard to do left organizing. So part of why I go on these shows is because I'm a nondescript middle-aged guy who doesn't scare people.
And from North Dakota, no less.
Yeah, I have that good flat Midwestern accent, and nobody gets too scared by nondescript middle-aged guys from North Dakota.
Our guest from the Great North, Bob Jensen, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Bob Jensen is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas, frequent guest on our show, and prior to your stint in academia, a working journalist for many years. If you'd like to call in and have a question or comment for Bob Jensen, the number 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We've got a couple of callers who are patiently waiting. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Yes, I just have a couple of things to note and then a question in that connection. This morning when I turned on my computer, I saw on MSNBC that Newsweek, there's a new story by Evan Thomas and Michael Isikoff. This story read like a kind of mea culpa written as a so-called news story because it was basically saying, you know, the government line, that especially the military's line, that they've had something like 30,000 documents and they've looked through them. They can't find references to Qurans being thrown down the toilet. And having read that and also recently going to Cy Hirsch's talk at the U of I, afterwards I spoke to him just briefly, and he said that even generals within the administration now refer to those in administration as being brown shirts and fascists. But, of course, he doesn't publicly say this, right, you know, personally with the small group of us.
We've outed that comment on this show. So.
Okay. I was really amazed when I heard that. But anyway, but the thing that gets me is that I get this sense that good investigative reporters like, Hirsch did not as great a degree. Maybe he's so famous he can, well, even publicly, though, he would not say that, right? And Isikoff, they're trying to take apart, on the one hand, externally, the real investigative reporters to threaten them in a variety of ways, obviously with their job, if not otherwise, but also internally threats to, let's say, administration officials. The official supposedly still says that he knew that there was this Quran, you know, flushing that went on, but he couldn't remember which page it was in this thousands, these thousands of documents he's seen. So he, of course, gets the message, boy, if we found out who you are, you know, you're not going to have a job, minimally speaking, or maximally speaking, something worse. And so I just wonder if there's just this kind of, what's the word, a strategy of the administration, perhaps quite open, of threatening the media. And the one thing that comes to mind is that I was in Japan at the time of 9/11. A few months after that, I was watching NHK, which is their national television, and or their version of PBS.
It's a public broadcaster.
Yeah, public broadcaster. Extremely good. And they noted they did a report in which they noted that a phone call had been made from the White House to CNN within months of the beginning of the bombing in Afghanistan, and that they were told that, you know, every time you report civilians have died, you have to say, this is in response to what was done on 9/11. And immediately they showed, you know, every time that they would, on CNN, you know, they would match it. You know, every time they would report on a death, they would say, this is in response to what happened on 9/11. And it was clearly related to the so-called threat that these anonymous sources had talked about, the White House having made this phone call. And I never really heard it in the American media, but I wasn't in the States for about a year after that. So I'm just curious whether you have a sense there is this kind of threatening going on by the White House, as well as, of course, the Pentagon and so on.
Did you have a second part to caller? Or is that it?
That's it. That's
okay.
Because
I'm going to let you hang up then so
okay.
Others can call in. Okay. Bob Jensen, Bush administration and the press. What's the story?
Well, of course, every administration does its best to control the press, to spin stories their way. There's nothing new about that. I think what's new is that the Bush administration, in purely technical terms, is better at it than I think any administration we've ever seen. Whatever one thinks of these guys, they're pretty good at what they do. The second point, I think, is that 9/11 allowed the administration some room to move that, quite frankly, I think any Democratic administration would have taken up too. That is, in this hyper-patriotic post-9/11 atmosphere, the administration can get away with a kind of bullying that it might not have been able to before, in part because the media, for the most part, the mainstream corporate commercial media, live in the same ideological world. There's a lot of sort of tacit agreement on some of this, and also because when the news media might have wanted to be more critical, more independent, there was a fear of audience. There was a fear of the reaction of the general public as well. All of that allowed the Bush administration to use the kind of techniques the caller identified. Some of them were fairly, you know, subtle in the sense of, you know, reminding people, as the caller said, and this did happen, you know, and it prompted a memo from the CNN chief to remind the broadcasters there to always mention, you know, the importance of 9/11 and why we're doing what we're doing in Afghanistan. And of course, there's the kind of pressure put on sources as well, and those threats are very real also. In other words, we have a free press, yes, and it's important to acknowledge that. We also have a press that, to a large degree, is subordinated to power, partly by its own choosing and partly by the commercial nature of the system. And in a sense, you would expect that given the structure of the system we have.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The number here, if you would like to call in to WILL AM 580, is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Chicago Western Suburbs.
Hi. First of all, I understand that Bush Sr., let us say, when he was with the CIA, told the news media that the CIA would have to approve everything that's on the air. But that's not my reason for calling. You could comment on that if you want. The guest stated that the reason why we've been very disrespectful towards the Quran, and et cetera, is so that we would get information from the prisoners. I would think just the opposite. If it were me, I would highly resent it, and I would be more stubborn. So my reason why they are doing this, being disrespectful towards their religion, is so that the Bush people will say that this is a religious war, which I think they are the ones who are creating it. I really don't think it's a religious war. So I'd like your comments, and thank you for your program.
Well, thank you very much. And Bob, before you answer that, let me just add something. I don't know if you saw Naomi Klein's piece mm-hmm. in The Nation, which I think really touched on the caller's question.
Absolutely.
Because Klein argued that the torture that's being done in Abu Ghraib and in Iraqi and Afghani prisons in Guantanamo and the rendering of prisoners to places like Uzbekistan where they're worked over and murdered isn't about getting information from people. It's about terrorizing a public to intimidate them. So it's all yours.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the first thing I thought of. Naomi Klein, one of the, for my money, one of the best journalists working in the world today, out of Canada, but also, you know, often training her journalistic talents on U.S. policy. Highly recommend her reporting from Iraq and the book that will be forthcoming shortly with that reporting. This torture question is very interesting because a lot of people in the business of interrogation will tell you torture is a very ineffective method because, as we've seen over and over again, if you torture people enough, they'll say basically anything. So professional interrogators will tell you that information that is obtained through torture is not all that reliable. The question is, why do we do it? Part of it, I think Naomi Klein's piece was very good in explaining. It is a broader strategy for terrorizing civilians to try and keep them in line. But we also have to remember that when people, you know, start in these imperial armies and these imperial endeavors, there's a kind of craziness to the whole thing. We saw this in Vietnam. That is, people will do things that are not terribly rational once they're in the field. Even people who are in the service of empire are humans, and there's a whole lot of, you know, irrationality in the human species, in case we haven't noticed that recently. And I think sometimes these things just kind of get out of control. In other words, you've got an interrogator who thinks, if I can just get this prisoner riled up enough, he will talk, and therefore the easiest way to do that is to insult his religion or sexually humiliate him. Of course, I think in the long run, those are probably, you know, ineffective techniques. But it's not always a rational process when you're in the middle of these situations, I think.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Bob, we've got another caller or two on the lines, but I wanted to follow up on an earlier question that a caller had about the Bush administration and its relationship to the media. One of the big stories of the past couple of weeks coming out of Washington is that the new Bush-appointed head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Ken Tomlinson, has apparently secretly taken it upon himself to go after what he calls liberal bias at PBS and has singled out one program, now with Bill Moyers, ironically not even on the air any longer, at least with Bill Moyers, as the exemplar of this bias. And this this is the purge that has to go on to get to not only get rid of this show or limit it, but at the very least to balance it with conservative shows. What's your take on all this?
Well, I think that it was a very unfortunate move, of course, and I think it shows fundamentally two misunderstandings, one about the nature of journalism and one about the nature of public broadcasting. As you're well aware, Bob, because your work has been important in pushing a public agenda on this, PBS, public broadcasting, the whole reason for it is to provide a space for those programs that would not otherwise find a place in the commercial broadcasting world. Well, it's exactly programs like Now, programs that, you know, give space to things that are not on commercial television, that we want PBS. So if you take seriously the stated mission of PBS, you would want more shows like Now. The other point is, I think it reflects this misunderstanding of journalism. Journalism is not to provide some sort of sterile balance. Journalism is, it, from my point of view, the core mission of journalism in a democratic society is to monitor the centers of power, to hold power accountable. Well, it just so happens the people in power right now are Republicans, fairly reactionary Republicans, the Bush administration. So, of course, you want journalism to hold their feet to the fire. In fact, the failure of contemporary corporate journalism, it has done such a poor job of holding this administration accountable for its policies. So if you really took seriously journalism and public broadcasting, you would not be you know, instituting these bogus studies of balance and the not-so-subtle political intimidation that is really the point of all of this, you would be celebrating any show that was critical, dissident, that was willing to raise these questions, and you'd be asking yourself, how can I put more of them on the air? I think it shows that, you know, media operate in a bigger political context, and it shows us just how far to the right this whole political culture has been pushed. I mean, compared to the rest of the world, the United States is a wildly reactionary political culture. And we have to start seeing that and realizing that media is one front on which we have to struggle, as well as the cultural issues, social issues, war issues. It's all part of, from my point of view, the same struggle to create a truly democratic culture.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today in Media Matters. We do have phone lines open if you'd like to call in and have a question for Jensen, who is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas and an author and a longtime journalist himself. The number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Terre Haute, Indiana, welcome to Media Matters.
Yes, good afternoon. Had the privilege of being at Champaign-Urbana for your Freedom of the Press and Can It Survive consolidation. Heard Naomi Klein and Amy Goodman. That was a real privilege. My question today, I'm afraid I've become a conspiracy theorist since 9/11 and the following. I have entertained this thought, and I wondered what your guest would be willing to speculate on it. Is it possible that Dan Rather and now Michael Isikoff at Newsweek were set up somehow by sources that then knew that they were going to deny that they were sources? I hate to be that cynical, but it has come to the point where almost anything is possible in media. So I would just enjoy hearing what speculations there might be out there about that.
Oh, thank you very much, caller. Bob Jensen?
Well, you know, certainly it's possible. I mean, I can imagine a set of facts that would support the caller's idea. And it's not unheard of course, in political, you know, dirty tricks to, you know, set up someone like that. It happens. Do we have any reason to think it happened here? I've seen no evidence of it. And in the absence of any evidence of it, I don't spend a lot of time worrying about it. I think, you know, we can look at these incidents and see that even without a conspiracy of the type the caller mentioned, we can see the way that propaganda works. We can see the game book, the game plan in some sense of the reactionary right. And we can counter that with or without any understanding of conspiracy. That is, on the Rather story and on the Newsweek story, there's one common theme. There was, in the case of Dan Rather, forged documents. But those forged documents weren't necessary to make the case that George Bush had skipped out on his guard service. There were other sources for that, and we already knew that. And the right wing used the forged documents, of course, to undermine the bigger story. Same with Newsweek. And we have to resist that. As people who care about media, as people who care about progressive politics, our job is to go into the public and constantly make the case for the larger analysis, the bigger story, and keep our eyes on the prize in that sense.
You're not a big conspiracy guy, as I recall at all, Bob, are you? I mean, you're not. You don't think the election was stolen in Ohio, and you're not from that crowd?
Well, I think, you know, do people do things that are dishonest? Are there attempts to maneuver and affect elections? Yes. Do they add up to a conspiracy in the sense that we could call the 2004 election illegitimate? It's not beyond the realm of the possible. I keep open the possibility. I just don't think I've seen evidence that proves it. And again, in the absence of definitive evidence that I can take into the public and argue, there's more than enough political work to do without going there. And I think, you know, I think of politics in long-term movement-building terms, and that means trying to get out there every day to use what we know to make the argument that there's a better way to construct a democratic politics in this country and go forward on that.
1 week from today on Media Matters, our guest will be the journalist Greg Palast. 2 weeks from today, I think coincidentally with what we've just been talking about, our guest is going to be Gore Vidal, who will be discussing, among other things, what happened in Ohio in the election and his concerns, as well as his critique of what's going on in this country and the world today. It's a show I don't think you're going to want to miss, an opportunity to have Gore Vidal on the air here. And then some of our listeners who pay close attention to our schedule and get our e-blast every week probably were wondering, why isn't Tim Robbins on the air today? We had scheduled Tim Robbins originally. He had a mix-up in his schedule, could not let us know late in the week he couldn't make it. Bob Jensen graciously joined us. We're making arrangements now to get Robbins back on the air, and we'll probably have him on in 2 or 3 weeks, the week after Vidal is the plan. But stay tuned. You'll get him eventually. And thank you, as always, for listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. We have a couple phone lines open for people who would like to talk to Bob Jensen. The number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Hi. I wanted to, there's so much noise being generated in this, in the war in Iraq and all the other levels of media. I wanted to, in regards to the defiling of the Quran and the attack on Islam as a faith, I wanted to remind people of what the case of Major Jerry Boykins, who was going around the country lecturing in his uniform and saying, you know, the most anti-Islamic stuff while Bush was posturing and talking to imams. But this guy was doing this grassroots thing all over the place. And there was something said similar along the lines I think it might even been from Powell, saying, well, look how we respond to this. Well, you know, he went up the ladder. He's now in charge of special forces, or quite high in the command of special forces, and probably is in both theaters in Afghanistan and Iraq all the time. So, you know, if for the military person, you know, this guy said all this stuff. He wasn't punished. He wasn't, demoted. He wasn't anything. He's in command. And that seems to me to, you know, be very, very telling. One of the things that's bugged me about the chat shows and in response to the rioting and stuff around the Quran is that there's this disconnect with, you know, the fact that people were killed. They seem to blame that on the people that were there protesting, as opposed to the repressive regimes that actually pull the triggers. You know, so it's a very strange reaction, it seems to me, and the fact that no one calls anybody on this kind of assertion is just outrageous. So I'll just hear your reactions to that, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. And Bob, again, let me just add one word before you talk about the Boykins thing. It does strike me as somewhat of an anomaly, if not a contradiction, that in the chastising of religious extremism in the Middle East, a blind eye is turned to religious extremism in the United States. And the reason I'm thinking of that is that numerous reports have come out recently about at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, how a significant percentage of the faculty or officers are born-again Christians and have taken advantage of their position on the faculty to aggressively promote their religious worldview.
Yeah, it's certainly a problem. Before I answer that, let me go back and just make it clear that when I said I didn't believe there was a conspiracy in the sense that the 2004 election was illegitimate, I didn't want to suggest that the abuses in the electoral system aren't important, especially the racialized abuses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had friends who were election monitors in Florida and had some real horror stories about the reality on the ground at polling places. So I think there's a whole lot of work to really bring fair elections to the United States, and I don't think we should ignore that. As the question of Boykin and the religious extremism, you know, this guy is he's a lieutenant general, and he's now the deputy, I think his official title is Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. He's the man in charge of all intelligence in the military. He's, you know, a radical extremist. He's public about it. And as the caller pointed out, it's extremely detrimental to the U.S. image, which we're supposed to care so much about. The other point, of course, is this isn't just about image. It's about policy, that you can try to spin the image all you want. But when the United States engages in policies such as, you know, systematic abuses, beatings, murders in prisons, it doesn't matter what's in the press. It doesn't matter what your PR people say. It matters what those folks know about the world. And I think that that's one of the main things the American public has to understand, is this isn't just about the U.S. being misunderstood. If the U.S. is misunderstood, it's misunderstood by the American people, who don't ever seem to come to terms with the nature of these wars, how brutal they are, and what they're really designed to do, which, of course, has nothing to do with democracy or terrorism. It has a lot to do with extending and deepening American control. Now, I would take issue only with one thing you said about religious extremism in the U.S. You said the administration turns a blind eye to it. I don't think it does. I think it encourages it.
Okay.
The Bush administration is very good, as I think the caller pointed out, too, of sort of talking out of both sides of its mouth. On the one hand, you know, Islam is a religion of peace and we love you. On the other hand, you know, really exploiting the religious fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism in this country for political purposes. It's an incredibly cynical ploy. It strikes me as very transparent as well. It's one of the places where I think the news media has been very reluctant to actually do hard reporting. In part, I think it's fear out of being, you know, chastised as being irreligious or perhaps even an instrument of Satan, which we all know, of course, the U.S. news media is an instrument of Satan. That's well known, but I'm sure that's not news to your listeners.
I'm sure it isn't either. We're talking to Bob Jensen today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live on WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. The phone number, if you'd like to call in and speak with Bob Jensen, 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And we've got a couple callers who've been very patiently waiting. Line 4 for Ina, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Hi. I'd like to make a comment and a question about your guest's contention that we've got bigger political issues to contend with. I think the election itself, if people aren't sure about who was actually elected and how they were elected, it's massively important that we watch the news all the time. We never heard follow-ups about these electronic machines and so forth. Also, about the Dan Rather story, and the Nigerian Yellow Cake story, who counterfeited these documents? We had a story from 60 Minutes where the secretary said that the contents of the documents were accurate, but she didn't. Where's the rest of the story? Where was the origin of the counterfeit? Also, that's my question. Also, the other thing about the lie by omission that these senators and other administration people, they'll give you a half-truth, and then it's, in effect, a lie by omission from everything from the filibuster to Bush's war record, et cetera. And thank you for your great show.
Well, thank you very much. Bob, fire away.
Let's go back to the election, because I think it's important to put this in some historical context.
Okay.
The 2000 and 2004 elections were not the first elections in U.S. history where there were accusations and likelihood of voter fraud. After all, I live in Texas now, and Lyndon Johnson, it's widely known, you know, got to the Senate his first time through the votes of a large number of people who were living in a cemetery at that point. It's often said that the votes that would have elected Richard Nixon president in 1960 were safely at the bottom of the Chicago River because the Daley machine in Chicago delivered that election to John F. Kennedy. You know, voter fraud is as much a part of U.S. history as it's part of any other country's history, quite frankly. It doesn't mean we don't care about it. It doesn't mean we shouldn't work toward it, especially, I think, as I said earlier, when there is a racialized aspect of this and you are literally disenfranchising one population, in this case, primarily the African-American population. But I think we have to keep it in some historical context. Also, as a political activist and organizer, you know, I also ask the question, where can we bring people together to resist what I think are the most important issues of the moment? And those are always tough questions to ask and answer. People, even people with the same political principles, may disagree. So I try to be open to all of these different perspectives, but also we have to make decisions about how we spend our time and what might be the most effective over the long term. That's, you know, again, not to undermine the importance of questions of electoral fraud. Where were documents forged? How, you know, this is one thing where I think investigative reporting could do much more to go past the superficial and down deeper. Right now, we have commercial news media in which there are very few people doing that kind of work and very few organizations supporting that kind of work. Seymour Hersh is an exception. He works for a magazine, The New Yorker, that cuts him loose to do that kind of work. He's got a track record. He's produced it. But if you go into
the commercial corporate newsrooms, you'll find that there are a lot of journalists, I think, who might want to do work like that, but are simply precluded from it by virtue either of the demands placed on them by management or specific instructions not to. At the Media Reform Conference in St. Louis, which I was able to attend, I sat in on the journalist caucus, and I got an earful of good, idealistic, working journalists in the corporate commercial media who are themselves frustrated with management, which is holding them off these, keeping them off these stories. That's one of the places where the media reform movement, I think, can help by bolstering the position of working journalists. I always try to make a distinction between those people who own and manage the media and those people who work at the frontline jobs. I think a lot of the people in those frontline jobs are very idealistic in the best sense of the word and want to do good work.
Bob Jensen, is there a website our listeners can go to find out more about what you're up to and what your writings are?
Yeah, the easiest place is go to nowarcollective.com. That's all one word, nowarcollective.com. And there you'll find links to my work and the work of some other folks I'm associated with.
Bob Jensen, I want to ask you only loosely related question to what we've been talking about so far, which deals with the internet and new media. A lot of people now in the indie media movement, and not exclusively there, Alex Coburn certainly fits in this school as well, say that the conventional media are entirely discredited, and that public opinion shows that people increasingly don't believe conventional media, that the usage rates for radio, television, news, for newspapers, subscription rates are falling, especially among people under 40. And they say that this now is a great thing and will push people towards the blogs, the websites like Alexander Coburn's Counterpunch, and that really we're set up now, we being those who are opposed to the dominant media system, to enter the fray, to provide something that will attract people and provide a compelling alternative. And that's really where the energy should go, providing that compelling alternative and not put a lot of time into criticizing the existing system. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think that media strategy has to be diversified. I personally think there is and should be a role for professional journalism. And by that, I mean people who have the job of trying to understand the world and communicate that to us. You know, journalism in itself is not inherently corrupt. There is a long and very important history in which journalism has had a very important role in bringing about progressive social change. So I think, I often defend journalists to some of my cohort on the left who think journalism is just sort of basically hopeless. If you want to understand the world, it takes time, it takes resources, it takes experience. And that's what we want journalists to be. I think we need to try to ask the question, how can we create the conditions in which professional journalism journalists can do their best work? I think we also have to create the alternative channels, the independent channels, such as websites, community radio, all those sorts of things. And I also think we have to continue to critique the mainstream media because, like it or not, the majority of the American public, I think, still gets their news from the corporate commercial media. Yes, people say, I never believe the media, but people watch it a lot. And I think if we don't hold the media accountable, we're going to lose out on a very important front. So I think, it's like most other things. There's a need for a diversified strategy. Different people within a movement might find themselves drawn to one or the other of those tasks, and that's good because people should do what they're passionate about. But I don't think it means the other legs of that strategic stool are irrelevant. I personally try to work on all three of those kinds of things, and I think all three are valuable.
Bob Jensen, you're a professor at the University of Texas, and shortly after 9/11, the president, I think it was, or chancellor of your university, mm-hmm. publicly singled you out as being a bad boy for comments you made after 9/11, bringing you a lot of publicity, whether you wanted it or not. And it seems that as I look around now, professors like yourself on college campuses are increasingly being singled out by political conservatives and the right is sort of not offering fair and balanced education in their classrooms. And this is a major problem, according to conservatives or some conservatives, with U.S. universities. Have you seen some of this in your campus, people saying you have an obligation to present sort of the Wolfowitz position on Iraq in your classes?
Yeah, of course. It's going on everywhere, especially at large state universities. And I think it's based on several fundamental misunderstandings, again, about what the nature of
higher education and the task of a professor is. My job is not to give equal time to all possible points of view. My job is to teach what I believe to be the most compelling way to understand the material that is part of the curriculum in my particular class. Now, there are disputes, of course, we'll stick to the social sciences and the humanities. There's always disputes about how to best understand and interpret the world, and I present those in class. I also don't hide the conclusions I have reached, because after all, would you want to pay people to go through what seemed like endless years of school and study and then put them in front of a class, but make sure they never tell you anything they've concluded? I mean, it'd be kind of strange, it seems to me. So you want professors to go in front of a class and, first of all, accurately describe the nature of the disputes in the field, but also convey to students the conclusions they've reached. The question should be not, is someone fair and balanced in some sterile way? The question should be, can you defend the conclusions you reach? Can you help students engage in critical thinking to critique your conclusions? That's really what the guts of education is about. I think what happens sometimes is, in my case at least, because I'm very public and I'm giving talks and speaking at rallies, people can't separate the Bob Jensen they see in public, who's very partisan, very political, and the Bob Jensen who's in the classroom. They assume that the way I operate in the classroom is to proselytize as I might try to do on a platform in public. Well, of course, I mean, Bob, you've been teaching longer than I have, and you know perfectly well one can separate the public political activist from the professional educator. And people just, unfortunately, can't seem to see that or don't trust that I can do that.
A part of the issue also is that they say a significant percentage of college professors, at least in the social sciences and humanities, are liberals. They're even on the left, and that this is an imbalance. It's not healthy for our society to have people in such prominent role be skewed ideologically or politically away from the great bulk of the population, which is an interesting argument. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, in the sense that if you look at professors, much like if you look at journalists, for instance, on certain kinds of what are generally called social issues, abortion rights, gay rights, that kinds of thing, you will find that professors and journalists tend to be a bit more liberal than the population. That's true. In other words, what you're saying is that those kinds of positions correlate highly with degree of education. All right. Now, liberal can mean a lot of other things, and unfortunately, what's gotten confused in the public discourse about this is liberal is also taken to mean sort of radical, anti-capitalist, communist, whatever. The terms lose their meaning. Now, if you look at the position of both journalists and professors on fundamental questions of the structure of the economy and U.S. foreign policy, you'll find, if anything, they tend to be centrist to conservative. And as you also pointed out, most of this discussion goes on by focusing only on faculty in certain humanities and certain social sciences. If you take the whole campus, of course, you have a pretty conventional institution. I always say that there's only one place on my campus I know where there is true ideological fanaticism and a kind of bracketing out of alternative views, and that's the business school.
Bob, if I can ask, we don't have a lot of time left, but I do want to follow up one other point. It seems to me if we're going to go after public figures and institutions where ideological balance is important, if we start with that premise, it strikes me that looking at world history, the military is the first place you would be concerned about, given. And no one seems to be talking about going in there and enforcing some sort of balance there so that at least maybe 10% of the officers might be Democrats.
No, what this, to sum all this up, I think it reminds us that when a political force starts using balance as the argument, what it means is they're in charge, they're running things, and they can use this false notion of balance to bludgeon the opposition. Now, there's no balance in a world in which a small elite control the vast productive capacity of the society. I mean, the University of Texas is not a radical institution. It's not even a liberal institution. It's an institution that reflects the interests of the people who make policy. And those people are, for the most part, from a very narrow strata of society. They will allow certain people like me to exist because of the nature of academic life and the need for academic freedom. But let's have no illusions about who runs this institution, who runs the news media, and in fact, who runs this society. That is dramatically skewed to the right and to wealth and power.
And they're the ones who try to get this argument focused on a kind of false balance.
Bob Jensen, I've unfortunately lost a couple callers who I think grew impatient as we were talking there. And I apologize to those callers who called in, and I did not have a chance to get to them. We do have two callers I do want to get to in the remaining 3 minutes before we go off the air. Line two, San Francisco, thank you for calling. You're on with Bob Jensen.
Quickly, I just wanted to call after you were talking about blogs and that type of thing in the media. I can't believe the amount of trivia that comes through on blogs and in the mainstream media. I just wanted to mention a wonderful essay Eric Fromm wrote called On Trivia in a book called On Being Human, or excuse me, The Art of Being, which I think is extremely relevant to anybody thinking about the nature of trivia and what is important. I mention that especially because I think Mr. Jensen shows exceptional personal courage and standing up for the right things. And I hope that people will delve a little deeper, look for that essay by Eric Fromm. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller. That was very kind of you. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Chicago, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Yeah, hi. I'd like your assessment on what I have to say. And that is that the 3 volumes of the biography of Lyndon Johnson by Robert Caro give you a good insight into the politics of Texas and therefore the politics of the present administration, since the people who were tied in with Johnson before he became president are of the same type. They switched from the Democratic Party, which was a Southern segregationist party, until Johnson had enacted the his racial laws, anti-segregation laws, and that sort of thing, that they became essentially the center of the Republican Party, and these are the same people who backed the Bushes and are now the power behind the throne in Washington.
I want to thank the caller for that. Unfortunately, we only have a little bit of time left, and I want to give you, Bob Jensen, a chance to talk about that. You are down in Texas. You've been there throughout the era of George W. Bush as governor and now, of course, as president. What's your take on this?
Well, I think the caller's right. Robert Caro's biographies of Johnson are very instructive as to how politics actually works. I live in Texas where, except for a few progressive Democrats, I can't quite frankly tell the difference between Republicans and Democrats. And what that tells me is we always have to go beyond the partisan Democrat-Republican framing of issues and really ask the question, who controls this society? And is it possible to have a meaningful democracy when the wealth of this society is so concentrated? Sometimes the difference between Republicans and Democrats matters, but often it doesn't. And I think that anyone who considers themselves part of a progressive or left political movement always has to keep that in mind, that the real progress in history in this country always comes from grassroots movements. Texas is certainly a place where you can see that so clearly, that if you want to play the game politically, Republican, Democrat in Texas, as far as I'm concerned, you've already lost. And for me, the focus is always on the grassroots, always on that long-term project of really claiming a different notion of democracy for this society.
Bob Jensen, are you working on any books now or any projects we should keep our eyes out for?
Yeah, I've got a book that will be out with City Lights in the fall on race, on white supremacy and white privilege. That's going to be called The Heart of Whiteness. I'm in the final phases of that. And I'm also working with some very talented filmmakers in New York on a documentary on the pornography industry, which is a whole other part of my work and research.
Well, Bob Jensen, we're going to get you back on the air. I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they're clearing me out of the studio. It's been a pleasure, as always, to have Bob Jensen as our guest here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours with Greg Palast. And I want to thank Andrea Boyle for being my producer. See you then.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high around 80 degrees with southwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s and northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, increasingly cloudy with the high in the lower 70s and northwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.